Thank you for joining for this episode of the TechSpective podcast. My friend Richard Steenen joins us. Richard, if you would like to give a little bit of intro and background on yourself.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Tony. It's great to be here, of course. I'm an industry analyst. Got into that realm in 2000. So it's been 24 years since I joined Gartner. And since then, I've started my own firm. And I'm just so focused on creating what I call a data-driven analyst firm. My timing for once in my entire career is good, because right when we were trying to do all this, OpenAI, generative AI, and large language models came into play, and I'm leveraging them heavily to actually build a service and platform and a database of all the data I can get my hands on about cybersecurity companies.
Okay. Yeah, you know, it is, you know, when you first did, you know, and we'll get to talking about this year's or whatever, but when you did, you know, Security Yearbook 2020, I'm actually a little bit curious, like, when you kicked off the, you know, and I mean, just so there's some frame of reference, I mean, it's 2020.
Nice.
But when you started it, and you started the project, and you know, and you've written other books, and, you know, you've written other books in the meantime. But did you envision it being its own, like taking on a life of its own, like Security Yearbook and the accompanying database are like a whole separate industry for you?
Yep. Yeah. Oh, completely. It was a pivot. You know, the business model behind writing books, you know, for an independent consultant, whatever, is public speaking gigs, right? You get paid for those book signings and all the rest, right? You don't make money on the books. And in 2019, I had actually written a book along with Jay Chaudhry at Zscaler called Secure Cloud Transformation. And I was basically sitting in their booth signing books, hundreds of people coming by at RSA 2019. And quite a few of the people said, hey, I'm brand new to the cybersecurity industry, and my employer sent me to RSA to learn about the cybersecurity industry. And, you know, veterans would laugh at the concept of being able to get anything out of that conference other than the current snapshot in time of what's hot. You know, 2019, you would have come away thinking XDR was security and everything else, don't pay attention to. And at the same time, I'd walk the show floor and I'd meet these startups in the booths along the periphery, and they'd have some new concept that they're so excited about. But every single one of them, I could say, oh, so you're like so-and-so from 20 years ago. And they would go, who's that? Never heard of it. In other words, we're losing our history. And only, I hate to think of myself as an old geezer in the space, but people are dying right and left, it seems. So how to capture that? Well, write a history book. So I had the simultaneous idea of writing the history of the cybersecurity industry, and this was a place to finally publish all the data I've been keeping for years and years, you know, just a big Google sheet of all the cybersecurity vendors. So that was the birth of it. And because it was the culmination of all that research I've been doing for so many years, it did feel like I planned on it being transformational. I calculate that, you know, there are 4 or 5 million people who are employed in the industry, you know, actually at vendors, but there must be tens of millions of people who actually do security. It should be really easy to sell 50,000 books into that space, right? When it's only history and the only place you can go where you can actually see the names of all the vendors. Of course, you know, it just turns out people don't buy books. You know, they don't, unlike you, look at the books behind you there. It's really, really hard to sell books. So that's okay though. You know, I got speaking gigs. Unfortunately, I launched Security Yearbook 2020 at RSA 2020, 2 weeks before COVID hit. And
right.
all speaking gigs seemed to shut down forever for me. So we're just not there anymore, but still the book is, I mean, it's my life's work. It's everything I know about the industry put in one place. It's very It's great for me because I rewrite it every year. Right? I have to read my own book every year to update it. So I, you know, I relearn the history every time I do that. I think I'm the only person who's read them all. And it's just a great process. And then, of course, this year, instead of paying for design and book covers and printing, I'm turning the entire process over to Wiley. So now I've got, you know, all of their editorial staff helping. It's going to be great, great book. And it'll be out earlier than I could get because Wiley has some pull with the printers.
One of the things I was going to bring up and ask you about is, you know, you and I, you know, I mean, I've written, you know, you talk about my books. Actually, my wall of books like yours is actually over here to my left.
Okay.
These books are just the ones that I either wrote or contributed to, and they're just strategically placed because they're on the video. But you and I have had conversations over the years about that process and about, you know, like, I mean, I still get, for my book, you know, like my main book, the one that I like literally, you know, brainstormed and thought up on my own and wrote beginning to end, because a lot of these I just contributed to.
Sure. Yep.
I still get quarterly checks or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, $9.43, you know, $15.18, you know, so it's like, and this book was, you know, this came out in like 2006 or seven, you know, so it's, you know, it's 17 years later. I don't expect anyone to be buying that book. Nobody should be buying that book now. It's, there's nothing in there that's relevant, but I still get these checks trickling in. And you and I've talked about how that model's kind of messed up. I mean, you know, like when I go out, I mean, I could probably, I mean, I have ideas right now. I could go pitch publishers. I could probably find one that would be willing to take one of my ideas. They give me some kind of a, you know, upfront, you know, payment or whatever. It might be 3,000. It might be 5,000, whatever.
Right.
But the reality is the chances that I'll ever make more than that and actually start getting royalties on top of it are slim to none.
Right. Statistically.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, you have your Dan Browns and your John Grishams and your, you know, whatever, you know, people out there.
In our space, Malcolm Gladwell, Michael Lewis, yeah
right,
do very well.
But you, at one point many years ago, made the, you know, went through this whole process in your own head, and decided to start self-publishing. And when you did the first three, the first three of these the Security Yearbook, you self-published these. Because, you know, and you know, like I said, you and I've talked about that, because I would look at it and I'd say, okay, well, you know, did my book sell a million copies? No, but it did sell whatever. Let's say it sold 20,000, you know, okay, well, why did I only see, you know, $3,000 out of this deal when they sold 20,000 books at $50 a pop?
Right.
You know, so it's like, if I cut out the middleman or four or five of the middlemen and just write a book and sell it directly, I could, instead of selling a book for $55, I could sell a book for $15, but I'm pocketing $12 a book.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. That's all the thought process that went through my head. The publishers, as you know, today expect the author to do all the marketing. You know, they just don't have resources or people who understand marketing. So the publisher has to do it all. But it is very expensive to print your own book. And the one huge, huge advantage that I've learned in going all the way with Security Yearbook and actually, you know, printing them, binding them, storing them in a warehouse, and then tying the sales to, you know, WooCommerce on my website, is that I have all the data on everybody who's ever purchased a book. Whereas if you sell through Amazon, the traditional way of doing self-publishing, you don't see that. You barely get to figure out what you're doing that causes sales. Whereas now, if I post about the book and I get three sales that day, I know exactly, you know, who read my post and got it. So data, and it just gives you insight into Amazon's business model. They know what everybody in the world buys all the time.
Well, yeah, I mean, I have, you and I talked about before I kicked off the podcast, that I have the collection, except for that for some reason I'm missing 2021. I don't know why. So I have 2022 and 23. So, I mean, I get it every year. And then I appreciate the format of basically saying, hey, we're going to do some chapters up front of like, you know, here's some interesting stuff. Here's some, you know, maybe a little bit of cybersecurity history, a little bit of profiling of, you know, a company or a technology. And then, you know, but then you get into the back half and you get into the data of it, you know, and it's a lot of data. I personally have used this, you know, so in my role as a, you know, freelance, you know, marketing consultant and content creator working for vendors. I mean, there are a number of vendors that I've had relationships with forever, but, you know, budgets dry up. And so I'll like open the book and be like, all right, well, there's 2,900 vendors in here I've never talked to, you know? Yep. So I can just start reaching out to companies and be like, hello.
Yeah. And now every day somebody reaches out and says, hey, you know, I was part of a riff and I'm looking for a job. And, you know, do you have any ideas? I said, well, you know, where do you want to work and what kind of companies do you like, you know, A round or mature companies? Once they give me those, I just run those filters through our platform and I send them a spreadsheet of all the companies they should reach out to. And based on the ones that got recent funding and the ones that are growing, right? Because
that's it. I feel like there's a you know, a side hustle business opportunity there where if you connect your database with like Indeed or you know or Monster or whatever and give people the ability to kind of filter that way and be like, all right, you know, I'm looking for a job. I don't, you know, like I've already worked for 5 startups. I want to work for a more mature company.
Yep. We've already ingested all of the LinkedIn job postings for all 3,750 vendors. I can't find a business model because when you're out of work, you don't spend money on finding a job, right? Because you're trying to cut your budgets yourself. So you're certainly not going to spend the $14,000 that we charge for access to our platform. So better yet, just give away the advice and suggestions and then, you know, when somebody gets hired, maybe their company will be a customer in the future.
Well, and, you know, aside from what I do with Techspective and Forbes and doing my, you know, freelancing stuff, I mean, I've, you know, for the past roughly decade, I've also had a full-time day job most of the time. And, you know, I've also been on the market now for going on 8 months. And, you know, last time I was on the market, you know, I had multiple interviews and I had 3 written offers within 30 days, you know, so within a month, I got to choose who I wanted to work for. This time it's like, you know, and I've had this conversation before on the podcast, but it's like, there are so many job openings out there at face value. Like if I go on LinkedIn, if I go on Indeed, it's like, there's plenty to apply to. But so many of them, like there isn't even an auto-generated response. Like you send this application into the void and you never hear anything.
Hiring has been frozen for the last 18 months. But my advice is hang in there. All hell is going to break loose. Despite, you know, today, February 21st, crazy things going on in the stock market. I'm convinced that we are entering into an era that will make the dot-com boom seem like a blip. The world of technology is going to impact the entire economy. We're going to be in boom times like none of us have ever experienced, similar to, I don't know, the California gold rush, maybe. It's just good times ahead, mind you, but the vendors who have been cutting back because their investors were so gun shy, right? The investors just got so scared, one by the stock market drop, but two by Silicon Valley Bank's failure. They just pulled in. They're just whimpering, right. Waiting for the sun to come out, and they're going to miss it. So the vendors that listen to their investors are going to go, wait a minute, we just hit our targets and exceeded our plan. And now we don't have the people to, you know, backfill and do all the work that we've sold. Well, and they're going to be competing with, they're going to be competing with everybody else to get those people now instead of, you know, hire now, hire today.
Right.
You know, don't let people go.
Right. Well, I was going to say on the one hand, I was going to point out that I've made the point a number of times when it comes to marketing. I feel like when companies, marketing is like often one of the first things to go. They look and they say, okay, well, you know, budgets are tightening. All right. Well, we still want to do product. You know, we still need to maintain operations. But let's, you know, we'll cut back on marketing. And I've made the argument where I'm like, look, the market, you know, the economy's down, market's down, whatever. Everyone's kind of like, you know, laying low. But it is going to turn around. I mean, you can look at the, you know, the history. It's like, yes, it goes down. It always comes back up. It is going to turn around. And when it does turn around, you don't want to be starting from ground zero. Like nobody knows what your brand even is or whatever. It's like, so there's a logic in my mind. And again, I'm biased because it's the industry I work in. But in my mind, right, you need to keep marketing because you want your brand to be top of mind when things turn around and companies start looking for, you know, ways to spend money again. You want them to go, oh, I, you know, now that I've got money, I want to go do that.
Right. Yep. Yeah. They'll pick up the phone when the salesperson calls because they recognize the company name and they recognize what you do. And they're like, yeah, we're ready. I totally agree with you. I guess, I don't know if I'd ever be a good, you know, venture-backed CEO.
Well, I'm curious, you know, so if your outlook, if your, you know, prediction and your optimism or whatever are in any way connected to or related to, you know, the current generative AI revolution, and I'll frame that somewhat by, you know, I again, I've had this conversation in previous podcasts, but, you know, I've likened this to the advent of Google. We had search engines, all of a sudden Google came along and it kind of just transformed everything. You mentioned like the .com boom or whatever. Like, I feel like it's an early kind of wild west. I mean, there's a lot of hurdles and hiccups that we need to address in terms of generative AI, kind of refining how we do it and stuff like that. But there's so much potential and every conversation I've had in the last year somehow comes around to generative AI. Like, everyone's looking for, like, how do I weave this in? How do I make use of this? How do I take advantage of this for our customers? And so, like, it seems like that is the next big thing.
Yep. It is definitely the next big thing. It is, in my mind, you know, so when I first discovered the internet, 3 years before Bill Gates, by the way, everybody back then had the same experience. They just go, oh my God, this is amazing. I can see all this stuff. I can send emails. I can talk to people. It expands the opportunities ahead of me. I dropped everything. I dropped my career as an automotive engineer, started an ISP, and never looked back. Right? Got into security shortly after that. But I watched, you know, I saw the numbers recently. So I got on the internet when there were fewer than 1 million people on the internet, which is early, you know, but it seemed at the time like everybody I knew was getting on the internet. And now, you know, we're at 3 billion people on the internet. The large language models, as, you know, revealed to us by ChatGPT in November, the end of November of 2022. So it's been 14 months. Had the same impact on everybody. It's like everybody sees it, goes, oh my God. It was the fastest growing consumer adoption of anything in history. Within 6 weeks, they had 100 million users of ChatGPT. Nothing like, you know, I remember when Lion King came out in video cassette back when we had those, right? Huh? They were so prepared for it that they had 5 million copies ready. And that was, at the time, the biggest consumer event in history. This is 20 times bigger and you know, 12 times more expensive. And yet people are paying for it. OpenAI is making $200 million a month on $20 million subscriptions. It's crazy. NVIDIA is growing 238% year over year, just selling the chips just to the OpenAIs and Googles and Microsofts who are training large language models. This is going to have the biggest impact on our markets, our economies, and our lives, of anything in our lives. You think I'm upbeat enough?
Well, I mean, and I don't disagree. I mean, you know, like I said, I think there are some hiccups and hurdles. And, like, you know, one of the conversations I've had is, the idea of having, you know, like the, to the extent that there's, you know, this tremendous potential for a large language model, that it makes sense to have more focused large, you know, like for instance, you know, like so ChatGPT, you know, I look at it and say, okay, well, its data set is the internet, you know, and it's trying to know everything or whatever. But you could create one, you know, create a more specific generative AI where you say, okay, well, my data set is just going to be everything there is to know about cardiothoracic surgery or whatever. And then it becomes much more refined where, like, when you ask it a question, you have, I think, a higher degree of confidence in the responses because it's not looking at the entire internet. It doesn't care what, you know, Joe in Nebraska said about cardiothoracic surgery. It's like it's a very specific information that it's pulling from.
Yeah, you know, it's a difference between intelligence and knowledge, right? And admittedly, GPT has more knowledge than any human will ever have, and it's that's available to it. But the question is whether or not it's taken all of that knowledge and somehow gained intelligence by being able to interpret it. And of course, for us, it feels like it's intelligent when you talk to it because it's crazy how good it is. And I think that's the important thing is if you had something that was, you know, at least as intelligent as a human and then gave it the, you know, the medical information you wanted, it could interpret that medical information better than a human because it has perfect recall and exposure to all the knowledge. So I think that's the excitement is they're working on that right now. A lot of people are working on that. And there's been a project, I think Google, has been working on folding proteins and that, you know, just looking at every single possible combination of everything in biochemistry to fold proteins, and it's starting to get results. And some people have turned OpenAI on to material science. So looking at every combination of materials and which ones will form a crystal lattice that does what, and they're discovering new stuff by doing that. So, you know, all those things will have, you know, just cascading impacts on our lives.
Right. Well, I think for me, the sort of moment of realization for, oh, this isn't just like a, you know, neat fad. This is a next generation thing was when I started hearing that Google was having a little bit of an oh shit moment about OpenAI. And I immediately thought of Microsoft and Netscape, how, you know, Bill Gates was like, that's not a thing. We're Microsoft. And all of a sudden Netscape took off and he's like, oh shit, the internet's actually a thing. Yeah. We need a browser now. And that's kind of where Google was. Google was like, oh, okay, we need generative AI now.
Right. Yeah, completely. So my most recent, you know, when you're working with this stuff, every day you go, oh my God. So of course, OpenAI created their GPT store, which is just, you know, you can just create your own GPTs and make them available to everybody else. I created one called Socrates Pro, which has all my books in it. So you can get it to, you know, use my thinking on the cybersecurity industry to write white papers and stuff like that. Fantastic. Somebody posted to Reddit, they had a GPT and it was, it created personas. So they had a CFO or whatever type of buyer persona for enterprise. So I went to it and I quickly got it to create a CISO persona. And we're in the process with our database of switching who our target market is, right? Right now it's all the venture capitalists out there, which there are 8,000. But our target market, as we switch to covering products, is going to be CISOs. So the classic, you know how this works. You call a bunch of CISOs and say, hey, I've got all this data. How would you like to see it? And how could you possibly use it? Well, you know, CISOs are very practical people. They don't imaginatively think about what could be in the future. So it's like pulling teeth, getting them to give you actionable insights that you can then turn productize, right? So I asked this GPT persona, what features would you like to see in a database tool for all 16,000 cybersecurity products, it just typed up 10 features in order that we're doing them already. So the first two it had, right? We've got the products themselves and exhaustive ability to rank them based on the vendor or what they do, and then comparative tools, stuff like that. Just that's going, we are going to build a product based on a product plan and roadmap generated by AI representing CISOs. So it's, yeah, it's mind blowing. That saves us 6 months.
Well, and you know, so yeah, obviously the, you know, the conversation comes around all the time. You know, I mean, it seems like every other headline related to this is about how, you know, the robots and the AI are going to take everyone's jobs and you know, to an extent, some of that will happen. You know, I had a, you know, the podcast recently with Sam Curry from Zscaler, and you know, and he drew the analogy of, you know, the advent of the automobile and the impact on the horse industry. It's like, yes, jobs went away. You know, like at least became niche artisan jobs that you only find, you know, it's like five people in the country know how to do. So, but it also creates an entire new segment of jobs out of thin air at the same time. So there are some pains to go through there, but for the most part, I feel like it's not that the jobs are going to go away. It's just the jobs change, the jobs elevate. Like, you know, when I look at the way cybersecurity in general is applying generative AI, a lot of it is level one SOC stuff. Can I feed totally. All of this data through the generative AI, let it do the thing that I would normally pay someone, you know, an entry-level person to like do the grunt work of weeding through this stuff and finding like, okay, what are the 10 or 20 things we should actually focus on? But generative AI can do that in the blink of an eye. Yep. And so now your entry-level workers in a SOC can do something else.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And hopefully something that leverages AI to get ahead. Now I was thinking of the poor SEO content writers, right, who wrote those horrible articles that just destroyed the value of the internet in Google, because all you can find is a stupid article that's just rehashed stuff and poorly written. You can really do that fast with ChatGPT. So all those guys would be out of a business other than the fact that they're already adapting, right? You know, they were kind of on cutting edge. If you're doing SEO stuff, you're a computer person and you're constantly worried about how Google changes their algorithm. So you're ready to change how you do things. Now you're just spitting that stuff out with ChatGPT. I don't know if, you know, an SEO content creator probably hasn't typed one word after another since this all happened.
Yeah, but, you know, at least when it comes to content and media, I feel like there's a self-perpetuating downward spiral there. And I talked about it a little bit. Like, so, you know, TMZ called me up one time last fall and I did a little interview with TMZ about generative AI because they were doing a thing about someone made a song deep faking someone. And we were talking about like, is this the, you know, the downfall of humanity kind of stuff. And I was like, well, you know, on the one hand, you know, ChatGPT isn't a silver bullet. It's not magic. It doesn't know anything that, you know, isn't already known. It's just Googling very fast and producing results. But I also said that it becomes a self-feeding spiral when ChatGPT is using the internet to get its answers, but then someone asks ChatGPT to create content and they put that content online. Well, now ChatGPT's mediocre content is its data set.
Yep. No, you're totally right. I think because all content since November of 2022 is going to be impacted by the large language models. So it's diminishing returns now. Now, mind you, maybe scientific papers and, yeah, the contents of the news outlets, et cetera, is all valuable and such, but it's being assisted by OpenAI and most for sure journal articles are. I think it's just diminishing returns, but luckily there's so much to be squeezed out of all human knowledge up to a year ago.
Yeah. Well, and there's also, there's a cultural or like a generational aspect to it as well. In that, you know, I make my living in large part writing blog posts. And like my wife and I were talking the other day and she was like, yeah, but does anyone read blog posts anymore? Like that's the, you know, and a lot of the stuff when you go, if you go to like, you know, if you go Google something or you just go to Google News and you say, okay, hey, what are the kind of emerging trending headlines? Like 90% of the links you click on take you to some sort of like bullshit slideshow content that, you know, you have to click through 75 slides and they actually never get to the point of the sensational headline that they started with. You're clicking through going, okay, but where's the actual news? And it turns out there isn't any. And so
recipes, same thing.
Yeah. Well, and so like, I feel like the sort of like, I'm going to fire the actual writers and I'm going to like, you know, rely on, you know, AI to create content becomes sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy of, yeah, see, nobody wants to read content anymore. And it's like, well, no one wants to read your crap content.
Right.
Yeah, like if you were writing good content, people would read it.
Yep. Yeah, I'm a reader, and I still would rather read than watch your YouTube video.
And you're still dating yourself. It needs to be on TikTok. No one wants to see your YouTube video either. It's like we all need to figure out how to take what we were going to put into a blog post and turn it into like a, you know, 30 to 60 second TikTok video.
Yeah, just like Twitter kind of destroyed long form blogging, because I found this for me, right? 80% of my blog's traffic used to come from Twitter. But over time, you know, you have an idea that you could expound in 800 words, or you could condense it to 256 characters and just get it out of your head and put it on Twitter.
Well, the other interesting thing for me is, you know, so I'll write a blog post and then I'll go post it and promote it on Facebook, LinkedIn, whatever. Yep. And I mean, I've got a good amount of followers on LinkedIn. And so, you know, depending on the, you know, I don't know, LinkedIn's, you know, the dark arts of the algorithm in the background. So I know that like not all 5,000 plus people are actually going to see my post necessarily. Right. But it's exposed to some segment of the LinkedIn population. Yep. And it gets a number of likes, it gets a number of shares, other people post it. And I can see all the analytics in LinkedIn. And what baffles me is that a lot of times I have better engagement or views of the LinkedIn post than the actual blog content. People are liking my LinkedIn post and then sharing it with others and saying, yeah, this is, you know, you should read this. But they themselves didn't read it apparently, because I don't have matching traffic on the blog post. And so it's like people are just liking and sharing the post about the post.
Yeah. Or if you include a statement about the post in your LinkedIn post, then that's what they're reacting to. Yeah, I've been tracking, and pretty much if I get 20,000 views of a LinkedIn post, you know, about my blog, then I'll get less than 1,000 views of the actual blog. So a 20th comes through. And if there's a call to action, out of 1,000 people who actually visit the blog and maybe read it, 6 will click on the link to whatever I'm directing them towards.
Yeah, I want to.
Sometimes I'll sell a book.
I was gonna say I want to do an Easter egg or something where I like at the very bottom of the blog post put in like a, hey, click here and you know you'll win this prize or you know whatever.
Right.
it's the prize for actually reading the content. But going back to your thing about as an author writing books, that it's not so much about the money you make from the books. It's about your brand and being able to get speaking gigs. You could look at the content the same way, like you're getting the visibility on LinkedIn. Like your brand is getting the exposure that you want. Whether or not people actually go read the blog content kind of becomes secondary.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. You're right. And then, you know, as you build that brand, I mean, I've got fans, three, I think, who will buy any book I write. And none of them are related to me. So, you know, so there's something, you know, out of 36,000 followers on LinkedIn, three of them buy my books. So that's, you know, just got to get more followers.
All right. Well, let's talk about, you know, so, you know, like we said, Security Yearbook 2024 will be coming out soon with the help of Wiley. You know, each year you kind of go back and read it and you come up with some new chapters and stuff. But I'm curious, you know, as you looked at 2023 and we're putting together 2024, like, you know, I was going to say aside from generative AI, but you can also say generative AI, but like, what are the kind of trends you're seeing, or, you know, what can we look forward to?
Yeah, the one thing I was expecting was that the downturn would have been bigger, right? Especially in March of last year when Silicon Valley Bank collapsed overnight. That seemed like a disaster. Silicon Valley Bank was the bank for about 500 cybersecurity companies, and they had a very trying weekend when they didn't know if they'd be able to make payroll the next week because they couldn't get access to their money. Luckily, you know, that just blew by, and it wasn't, you know, long-term didn't seem to have that bad an effect, but it spooked investors. So investors, you know, have never learned the lesson buy low, sell high, right? That pretty much they buy when everybody else is buying is the trend that they follow. And so but despite all that, we still saw just over $10 billion in new investments, which was the same number of investments as we had in 2020. So in 2020 was a record. $10 billion was the first time we'd ever seen that much invested. And that wasn't too long ago. It was the beginning of COVID. So yeah, we had a blip in there, you know, where in 2022, there was 2021, there was $26 billion in cybersecurity investment. Those days, that was definitely overheated in retrospect, but I say we're back on an even keel, steady growth. And there was, I forget the number, maybe 320 new investments and 225 or 250 acquisitions last year, which was down 25% from the year before, which is also strange. Hey, if the valuations of all these companies are down, how come strategic buyers are being conservative and not buying, right? It's because they're hearing from their stockholders saying, hold back, don't scare us by buying things. I think, you know, in addition to everything else that's going on with the economy, I think that there'll be more acquisitions this year because the strategic investors, strategic buyers start to see that, yeah, it's okay to spend money, they will. And they'll start snapping up some of the companies that ran out of cash so far. And we're going to see more investments this year than last year for sure. I'm predicting $15 billion. Let's put that stake in the ground. But it could be a lot more than that because there's a lot of dry powder sitting out there. It's, you know, billions and billions of dollars of money earmarked for cybersecurity investments. And once we get into that frothy fear of missing out kind of thing that the investors just invariably lead themselves into, they'll be upping those valuations again and we'll have crazy times.
Well, it is crazy times. And you and I've talked before about, you know, that a lot of the, you know, sort of sky is falling headlines you see are you know, not necessarily borne out with the actual data, there is money, it is flowing. It's just, you know, maybe not where you see it. But I also feel like there is, and this goes beyond cybersecurity, it goes beyond this conversation in general, but there's a dividing, there's a disconnect between what companies and investors look at and say, oh, the economy's good, the economy's bad. I mean, like, you know, every single day in the news, you know, it's a headline, the Dow went up, the Dow went down, the S&P went up, the S&P went down. And yes, people have money in 401ks and IRAs, and so they do have some stake in the game. But for the most part, like, that's not an for 90% of the population, that is not an accurate measure of is the economy good or not. Like, the Dow went up, the Dow went down doesn't change, my life. Right. And bringing it back to this context, investing went up, investing went down. Like, yes, I think there is a trailing effect on the job market, but it doesn't seem like companies that had huge investments, still laid people off. Companies that just, Cisco just bought Splunk and spent an ungodly sum of money. And then, this week let a bunch of people go. So it's like, there's a disconnect there, or at least different priorities, where like it doesn't necessarily, there doesn't seem to be a direct relation to the actual like people working in the company and the jobs available.
Yeah, a lot of public companies wait for everybody else to have layoffs, so that, especially the ones that are super stressed. So then the Ciscos of the world who aren't super stressed can use that as air cover for making layoffs. And, because a lot of people follow the old GE methodology of laying off 10% of your people every year, right? Which is really, really cruel. But it's stack ranking. Hey, you're on the bottom. Performers, you're out. Keeps everybody on their toes and stressed out, I assume. And that's, you need that air cover, right? If it's boom times and you're laying people off, investors, the stockholders are going to go, you're an idiot. Figure out a different way, because it's expensive to lay people off, right? It's most of the companies give them big severance packages. Not ever when I was laid off.
I was going to say, I feel like the packages have gone down, from my own experience, but no, it's a good point. And there's investment in, finding new talents and hiring them and onboarding them. And the institutional knowledge that you give up when you lay people off, there are costs involved with all of that. Yep. I forget where I was going with that.
I'm not a fan of layoffs, right? Unless, when you're in trouble, for sure. But
it should be, my opinion is it should be it is your last resort, not your first move. It's your, people always say, it's not personal, it's just business. It's like, yes, I understand there are business factors and it can be just business. It can be a business decision for sure. But companies, I feel like, should also have some level of empathy for people like made life choices to take that job. Like, maybe they moved, maybe they decided not to move. Maybe their spouse or significant other didn't take a different job so that they could take this job. Whatever, there's a lot of factors involved, and people have lives and families and kids who are doing things that cost money. And, there's this like companies expect a level of like dedication and loyalty from employees, but then are kind of cavalier about, okay, but we've made a line item decision here that your role is no longer needed. Goodbye. Thank you. It's been fun.
Right. Yep. Yeah. And you got to wonder about, maybe Cyber Reason had to have their huge riff when they did, but Dragos, they're top of their game. Now they own the space. They practically have a monopoly on mindshare anyways. Was that smart to lay people off?
Well, and the other thing I was going to say is that, and to your point about you wait for there to be cover, it's like how everyone spent like all of the last year was going on and on and on about, inflation's horrible. That's why the economy's bad. We got to let people go. We're cutting all these things. And then everyone had like record profit. And I've made the argument a number of times in various Facebook arguments and LinkedIn arguments where I'm like, you can't cry inflation and then have record profit. It doesn't work. Like, if there was record inflation, it should have also impacted your bottom line. So like, if you're Exxon and Shell, you can't simultaneously say, the price of oil, what are you going to do? And then have record profit.
Right. Yep. Yeah. And I understand the... it's PTSD, I think, for economists, because in the 80s and 90s, or 70s and 80s, inflation was rampant, right? 25% every year. That was bad. It happens to be really, really good if you're in debt, right? If you've got college debt or real estate debt and fixed terms, then inflation is the best thing that could happen to you. It's like a gift of money every year because you owe less in real terms. So there's ups and downs. And as a matter of fact, inflation is the best thing ever for the government because, boy, do they have debt, right? Trillions of dollars of fixed interest debt. So if they are, if they have to pay 6 or 7% on treasury bills and inflation is more than that, they're making money. It's just the way it works. So, yeah, inflation isn't the bugaboo, I think, that they make it out to be. And it's inflation is a sign of a overheated economy. It means the economy is growing. It means that people are fully employed. It means that prices are going up because of that. There's scarcity.
Well, and
those things are good too.
Right. I mean, yeah, right. And there definitely are, you know, economic like algorithms that I don't understand that make those things make sense. But bringing it back again to cybersecurity is like, you know, for companies to be like, oh, you know, the market's bad, so you know, we had to lay off 1,000 people, we had to lay off 2,000 people, or whatever. But then they do their, you know, their quarterly reports, and they're like, we made record profit, and it's like, and I, on the one hand, I realize that that's partly because they laid people off, like that's why they laid people off, so they could say that. But again, then I come back to the thing about, okay, but laying people off should be a last resort. You know, you should think about the human beings who are being impacted by that decision. And, you know, if that cuts a little bit into your record profit, then, you know, so be it.
Yep. Yeah. There should be a measure of employee loyalty and treat it like a bookkeeping thing, right? The more you treat them well, the higher loyalty you have, less turnover, right? You don't have that attrition going on and you can bank on it. Right. When during really hard times, you can ask them to give things up and they'll stay because they're loyal to you. And that's got to be worth something to kind of the play on goodwill. Right.
Employee. Well, I mean, that's, you know, you're in the Detroit area, so you're very familiar with this. But like the unions went to, or the automotive you know, manufacturers went to the unions during COVID and said, hey, we need some concessions from you. And they gave them.
Yeah.
And then Ford and Chrysler and GM were like, we're just going to let this ride. And the unions had to go back and be like, oh no, see, things have changed now. We want our concessions back.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
But yeah, I mean, and it's crazy because, you know, I've seen, you know, obviously there's thousands and thousands of people who are getting laid off, but then I see people who I've known for, you know, years and respect getting laid off, where I'm like, well, shit, they're like the best at what they do. If they're getting laid off, what hope is there for me?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But
yep. Well, we all learn that.
Yeah.
That axe can fall at any time.
Well, right. Well, so, but let's bring this back then, you know, so you have this optimistic view. You have an optimistic view of, you know, the tech world in general, the investment landscape. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that, you know, I know that you analyze these things for a living, and so I have a level of respect for your opinion on the subject. So I'm like, you know, all right, if Richard says things are looking up, then I'm gonna assume things are looking up.
Yep. And I guess with the caveat that I'm forever an optimist, and if I was so smart, I'd be rich in stock market calls, and obviously I'm not. So there's that too.
Yeah. Actually, one more quick thing on the letting people go. I think the worst of those to me are the ones where they literally just hired them.
Oh yeah.
Like I know people
still in the onboarding process. Yeah.
Yeah, like I know people who like were hired and, you know, like they left stable employment because they were poached and lured over to go, you know, take this, you know, higher salary working for like, you know, Facebook, Netflix, Google, whatever. Yep. And like within 3 months were let go. Yeah. And it's like, what the hell?
Yeah. like the, I think the woman at Cloudflare that became internet famous for her termination, she was still on probation from being
hired. I mean, and there, to Tenable and Matt Alderman's credit, when I joined Tenable, I started in December, like almost mid-December. And so, you know how December goes, everyone's on vacation. There's nobody there. So I'm trying to onboard. I'm trying to, like, you know, get my bearings and, you know, figure out, like, who do I talk to and what's my job exactly? And didn't make a whole lot of progress the first, you know, 2-3 weeks because there's nobody around. Yeah. So I was just kind of like hanging out. And like the first week of January, I get a call from Matt Alderman, who I did not know at the time. He's like, "Hey, this is Matt Alderman. You know who I am?" I'm like, "No." He's like, "Well, I'm your boss's boss's boss." I'm like, "Okay." He's like, "Just letting you know, your boss and your boss's boss no longer work here, and neither does anyone else on the team that you were hired to join." And I was like, "Okay." But I was not let go. He was like, "But I'm calling to let you know that, like, we're just moving you. Like, you know, like we dissolved that team, but we're gonna put you over here instead." You know, so I'm like, "All right, put up. I can roll with that."
Yeah, I like that. That's great. Congratulations.
So, but it was still a little bit daunting. I'm like, "I've been here 3 weeks and you dissolved my whole team that I haven't even met yet. What?"
Right. Oh my gosh.
So.
Oh great. This has been great. Tony,
yeah.
I really appreciate your having me on. We'll have to do
it. Yeah, no, thank you for taking the time, and I look forward to Security Yearbook 2024.
All right. I can't wait to see it myself.
All right, take care.
Thanks, Tony. Bye.
I appreciate you investing your time to listen to the podcast, but I also invite you to engage on social media. Please go like our Facebook page and follow at Techspective on Twitter and Instagram. You can feel free to let me know what you like, let me know what you don't like, let me know if you love it, let me know if it sucks, and let me know what products you'd like to see reviewed or what questions you'd like to see answered in future posts.